This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with attorney Natasha Bonin, the former president of the National Lawyers Guild, who's just returned from the island of Puerto Rico, where, as you'll hear from her report, a huge rebellion, even as she suggests a revolution, is underway. We speak also with attorney Kevin Zeese, one of the embassy protectors, who along with three others was arrested for protecting the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. against the attempted coup in Venezuela last month. We're joined in our interview with him by Natasha Bonin, who was down at the embassy during some of the activity there.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
President Donald Trump's recent attacks on four congresswomen, people of color, telling them to go back home, echoes the dehumanizing demagoguery of fascist strongmen who use race baiting to scapegoat and divide and conquer. Victimizing Latinos has been a strategy of Trump's ever since the election, when he called Mexicans criminals and rapists. After Hurricane Maria wrecked the American colony of Puerto Rico in 2015, killing nearly 3,000 people and severely damaging the electrical grid, Trump went to San Juan, where we saw him throwing paper towels at people. Here to speak with us today is the former president of the National Lawyers Guild, attorney Natasha Bonin. She currently works as associate counsel at the New York City-based Latino Justice. She graduated from CUNY Law School, where she was editor-in-chief of the CUNY Law Review. She wrote an article for that journal called Puerto Rico's Odious Debt, The Economic Crisis of Colonialism. She's on the board of directors of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Attorney Natasha Bonin, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Let's first speak about the situation in Puerto Rico, and then the situation involving refugees on the border. The people of Puerto Rico, who are still recovering from the terrible effects of Hurricane Maria, are also burdened by what has been called an odious debt obligation. What kind of recovery did the Puerto Rican people make from the hurricane's damage?
There really hasn't been much of a recovery. The recovery that I think folks see when they go to the island now as tourists is really superficial, right? It means that for the most part, electricity has been restored. There's running water in most places. All of the things that were originally pretty atrocious and really kind of shocking to the conscience that folks saw after Hurricane Maria devastated the island. You know, it was the largest hurricane in the history of the island and the third worst natural disaster in the history of all U.S. jurisdictions. It continues to be felt to this day and will be for generations. And that's because it really just uncovered deep structural inequalities that already existed. When we think of recovery, we're really trying to talk about a just recovery. What does a recovery look like that centers Puerto Rican lives and that prioritizes them and what they need in order to be able to live dignified lives? And it isn't just water and electricity. Obviously, those are critical components, food as well. But it's really about, you know, how do we think about rebuilding an island that is going to be sustainable, not only economically, but also kind of structurally, environmentally, institutionally, that's going to be able to withstand future climate change devastation, particularly for a Caribbean island that is centered both in terms of geographically positioned in a really compromising place, but also because it bears the brunt of policies that are being made, particularly by the United States, that compromise its well-being and sovereignty, its environmental sovereignty, its food sovereignty, its economic and political sovereignty. And so the recovery that is so often talked about and really associated often with FEMA has never arrived. It's never made it to the island. People are still waiting on it. And that's not just because of the billions of dollars that have been allocated in Congress that are being held up by this administration, but the money that is flowing, we already know, has been intricately tied to corruption. I mean, we see these really shady contracts. Think about the Whitefish scandal that happened, you know, just a few months after the hurricane, a $300 million contract that was awarded to a small firm in the Midwest, somewhere Montana-like, to two people who had never had any experience, not only with Puerto Rico, but around some of these issues. And so, you know, the demand of Puerto Ricans is really for a just recovery, a recovery that looks at sustainability, both environmentally and structurally, and that we have yet to see arrive at the island. That being said, there are people on the island that work for this and on this issue every day, and they have before the hurricane, that really understand, because it is essentially their lives and the lives of their children that are at stake, that they are going to have to be responsible for taking control of their island's food supply, water supply, renewable energy supply, and are building out those models for the rest of us to support.
As we sit here, we're witnessing the greatest rebellion of the Puerto Rican people that we've seen in our lifetime. A couple of days ago, there were at least 500,000 people. This is an island of 3.5 million. 500,000 people were in the streets demanding the resignation of Governor Rosello. What triggered that huge demonstration?
Well, not only the 500,000 people that I had the honor of being a part of, but the Paro Nacional, the national strike that just happened a couple of days ago, was estimated to be 1 million. You know, 1 million on an island of a little bit over 3 million. That means that nearly every household was represented in this national strike. It's been now nearly 2 weeks of daily protest that was initiated, really, with revelation of 889 pages of text messages.
Yeah, those are amazing. So insulting, so demeaning. And these were sent out by the governor and the people around him, two of whom have already been indicted. What were the nature of those text messages?
That's exactly right. It was a private chat between the governor and some of his cabinet members, his advisors, his highest level advisors, his chief of staff, lawyers, that in essence were homophobic, misogynistic, and sexist, that talked about the corruption that his administration has been laced with since the very beginning, that were insulting to the deaths, the thousands of people who died after Hurricane Maria, that made fun of them, that made fun of people for their body size, for their physical appearance. It really revealed the intent behind a lot of the policies that this administration, the Rosello administration, has already implemented. And people could see, you know, what they felt with their lives because of policies of austerity, you know, of collaboration with the Fiscal Control Board, liberalism, and really displacement and policies around gentrification. And then you see the intent behind that. You see unabashedly the governor and his closest cronies calling women whores and sons and daughters of whores, speaking of, you know, international artists in homophobic terms, and really plotting out the corruption that, you know, that the administration has been accused of. It was the Center for Investigative Journalism, Centro Periodismo Investigativo, that was responsible not only for making public those texts, but then also, after reviewing nearly 900 pages of those texts, issued a preliminary report that shows all of the corruption-laced language that is tied to this administration, and shows kind of what has been a pattern of lack of transparency, of refusing access to journalists that they felt wouldn't portray them favorably, talked about their political opponents. I mean, these are things that we think of Trump doing, right? And the same type of misogynistic and homophobic behavior and language as well, you know, how they're going to personally benefit, and people around them will benefit from contracts and from contacts, and everything removed from public scrutiny and sight. This is the exact policies that we hear and see so much associated with the Trump administration. And yet here you have this governor who who's been doing this and the long legacy of his family's dynasty. His father was also accused of corruption and was a disgraced governor. And here we have, you know, this legacy being carried out until the people decided no more. And it was really making fun of the dead that did it. Over 5,000 people who died as a result, not of a natural phenomenon, but of gross criminal negligence by the government, by massive abandonment and neglect. And to have this governor, who was so willing to sell out those lives for his political agenda, to tell Trump that he had done a great job in Puerto Rico, then make fun of the dead, was the last drop that really, you know, overflowed this cup of bitterness and deep pain and suffering on the island. And that indignation is what we're seeing on the streets.
Well, you've just come back from the island. What was it like? What were the demands that the demonstrators were raising? Talk about that, please.
It was magical. I have to say, I never thought in my lifetime that I would get to see the Puerto Rican Revolution. And that's exactly what we're witnessing. There was the Arab Spring, and this is the Puerto Rican summer. We're seeing the uprising of a people who have been colonized for over 500 years, 121 years by the United States government. And these demands go far beyond the resignation of this governor alone.
Talk about this, the demands, please.
This is much more than just the actions of one individual. It's more than the actions of 9 individuals who were on that chat. This is really the same way that we saw after Hurricane Maria, where in the face of that government abandonment, people began to slowly redefine their relationship with their government and to not expect so much and to look to each other to think about, well, how do we create systems of interdependency if we can no longer, as a colonized dependent nation, rely on our government? The exposing of, you know, the governor's real kind of beliefs and those around him and what he built around him was also the breaking point for people that said, we are going to demand a different system of self-government. And it starts with you, but it doesn't end here. The crux of their demand is respect and dignity. It is a people who will no longer be bent. They won't have their will be bent. They won't be on their knees anymore. They're standing up. They're finding their voices. People who have never participated in political life, who have never showed up in a democracy in this way, who've never protested in their lives, teachers and lawyers and retirees and students and people of all political parties who are saying, this is not just about me. This is about my grandmother who died, my aunt who died, who was left there to die, my children who are having their education being taken away, my pensions being taken away. This is a redefinition of the social contract. This is a new relationship that's going to evolve between the people and their government and what they demand of their government. Whoever has the honor of occupying that space next and in future generations is going to have to understand that they will be held to the exact same standards. And more than that, this is a redefinition of the relationship with the United States. One of the most common chants wasn't just Ricky renuncia, like resign, Ricky the governor, but it was also saying, and take the Federal Fiscal Control Board with you. We don't want a colonial government. We no longer want to be subjected to any other interests that are not our own as a nation. And the demands really center and recognize colonialism. And are going to move towards pushing that further. That isn't just about, well, we hope at some point there's enough political will in the United States for folks to take up our cause of freedom. They're going to be pushing it and demanding it in ways that I think the world is going to want to watch and pay attention to.
What kind of policies does the colonial government of the United States impose on Puerto Rico that have to be changed? Let's start off with the debt and the organization that was set up to extract money from the Puerto Rican people.
So the debt, the fiscal crisis, the debt of $72-73 billion that was declared unpayable several years by the prior governor eventually led to this federal law known as Promesa, which was intended to allow Puerto Rico kind of an opportunity to restructure that debt. That debt, by the way, doesn't even include the public pensions that were being stolen from to pay back the creditor. So we're really talking about somewhere closer to about $140 billion. But that law called Promesa came at a very high political cost, which was the imposition of a control board, a federal fiscal control board composed of seven financial executives and from the financial world that serve in their individual capacity, that meet in private, that meet on Wall Street, that are unelected, that have veto power over the local elected government, including the governor and the legislature, that have the power to impose fiscal policies that are based on austerity and, in fact, have the mandate to do so. And in essence, is the most anti-democratic form of government that can only exist in a colony. We'd be outraged if we saw this in Venezuela, for example. We'd be condemning it blatantly. But in a colonial government, this is what's been deemed acceptable, that Congress can essentially delegate its authority over the island to an unelected board of bankers and financial executives that come from the very institutions responsible for indebting the nation. That debt has widely been challenged on the island by the Puerto Rican people as unconstitutional, as illegal, as immoral, and unpayable. And people reject outwardly the notion that it is a public debt. It is not the debt of the people. It is a private debt that is held primarily, at least in half, by hedge funds, by vulture funds that have historically circled, you know, distressed communities, whether it's, you know, in New Orleans, whether it's the foreclosure crisis, whether it's Puerto Rico, to advance neoliberal policies and to advance policies of deep displacement and gentrification, and to you know, at the expense of remaining with the people's land. And that's exactly what we see. What we see as a result of this debt, essentially, policies that are designed to restructure the full society, that are promoting massive migration and displacement of Puerto Ricans and incentivizing literally bankers. You know, there's laws that talk about financial executives who won't have to pay capital gains taxes, for example, if they can live in Puerto Rico for half of the year. Well, what does that mean? That means that you're going to have the privatization, as we see, of historically public goods and services on the island, privatization of education, of infrastructure, of healthcare, of roads and airports, you know, everything that we have, energy sources. That has been the model that's been pushed. That is also a part of this demand that we're seeing on the streets, where people are recognizing that this widespread corruption is also about the complicity of their colonial government with a larger imperialist agenda that not only does not prioritize their needs, that is contingent upon their eradication, of ensuring that, you know, as one of the, they call it the manada, one of the members of the chat said, this famous text message that said, I saw the future. It was beautiful. There were no Puerto Ricans.
that's the essence of it.
That is the absolute crux of what we're talking about.
So I assume that this magnificent mobilization is going to cause Governor Rosella to depart. He's got one foot on a banana peel already. But what are people talking about in terms of...
they're expecting his resignation today.
Well, this is going to be old news by the time we broadcast the show, Natasha. We're speaking with Natasha Bannon, who's an attorney with Latino Justice, who's just returned from the island. Natasha, what do you envision happening after Rosella leaves? What kind of structure would the people like to be put in place?
Well, the Constitution allows for, you know, successors. The challenge of that is that the immediate successor would be the Secretary of State, but the Secretary of State resigned because he was one of the implicated in the chat. The Attorney General, the Puerto Rican Attorney General, is next in line, and she's expected to take place as interim governor. She's not popular either on the island. And more than that, I think, you know, this, as I mentioned, that this isn't just about, well, who is the person that's going to come into place? This is really about rethinking the very structures and institutions that have been in place that have allowed for the systemic kind of corruption and oppression that has happened, with lack of citizen oversight, lack of transparency, lack of accountability, and where people have been demanding that of their government and haven't received it. And there was kind of a resignation that that was just how it was. It's been decades like that. And what we've seen is a critical shift in consciousness of people who will no longer be complicit or silent in the face of governments who do not understand that they answer to the people. And that it's the people who put them there. And what we've seen really is also just tremendous admiration and outpouring of support from people around the world that are paying attention and watching and are drawing great inspiration from saying, I would love to be able to take out my corrupt elected officials. And I didn't think that that was possible. And people who didn't ever expect that this little island nation would rise up in the way that it has. You know, when you think of Puerto Rico, you think of perhaps you think of the hurricane, you think of the devastation, you think of these poor people who were left to die on their own, or you think of music or sports, but you don't always think of this rich legacy of rebellion that the island has had and that the Caribbean has had, and that they're drawing that strength from. And this is also really being led, and I want this to be very clear, because this was obvious to me every single day that I was on the streets protesting. And you know, when we got tear gassed, I think I was the oldest one around me. This is a movement that is being led by young people who are so politically clear about what their demands are, and that they understand that it is their futures that are being played with, that is their right to education, their right to dignified employment, their ability to stay on the island and not to be forced to have to leave, that they don't want to have to be the only ones taking care of their family members because their pensions were obliterated. They're so clear that this is more than just about what the obligation of government is, that this is also about how do you govern from the from a gendered a perspective that centers, you know, a gendered analysis, a racial analysis, an analysis of those who've been historically the most vulnerable and oppressed in a society that has refused to acknowledge and to center them. And those are their demands. They really have a very intersectional approach to what they're saying. The immediate demand is the governor's resignation, but it really goes far, far beyond that to, you know, what do we want? How do we want to govern ourselves as a nation? And that is the heart of, you know, if I think of the conversations that we're going to hear about and participate in to come, how do we want to govern ourselves? Not who do we want to govern us? Not who is going to try to come and govern us. Not the arrival of dozens of federal agents who are going to be seen as the ones who ousted the governor, and not the people. But how do we want to govern ourselves? And that is always, I think, kind of the critical inquiry at the beginning of any process of self-determination.
When you were there, did you see the beginning of the formation of independent branches of power that come from the bottom up?
Well, the whole movement is bottom up. And I have to say it's also reached into sectors of society that have historically not felt moved to participate in kind of political processes the same way, or in democratic processes, which ultimately, you know, protests are about. There was, you know, one of the kind of more well-known anecdotes is that in numerous of these protests, there have been motorcycle brigades that have been summoned by El Rey Charlie, this kind of self-nominated King Charlie, who's a motorcycle enthusiast and trainer and teacher on the island, who has 200,000 followers and was able to bring out motorcycle enthusiasts, four-track enthusiasts who come from the caseríos, who come from public housing and from the projects on the island, who come from some of the poorest spaces and communities, people who haven't necessarily participated in the labor movement, you know, in organized spaces before, but who see this individual who is speaking their indignation about the lack of respect that they have received and are feeling that indignation and feel themselves summoned to this particular political moment in history as one example, right? I have numerous examples of people that I know that participated that brought neighbors with them who in their lives had never shown up at a demonstration before and yet who recognized that this was about more than just this governor, that this was about them demanding respect and being seen as having inherent dignity and demanding kind of a new vision for their nation. And so to see so hundreds of thousands of people who have never participated democratically in this particular way before feel so compelled to do so because it was the stake of the soul of their nation that was at, you know, that's being played with is something that I have to say most of us didn't think we'd get to see because the island has been trampled on for so long. It's been a colony for 120 years and has historically been used as a testing ground for U.S. neoliberal and military policies. I mean, the latest of this colonial control board that has imposed policies of austerity that has eliminated, obliterated public programming, that has closed over 400 public schools, that has tried to slash the budget of the highest education system, the largest public education system, university system in the Caribbean, in half, precisely because it's been a training ground for progressive political thought. That is, you know, where you have, you know, healthcare clinics that have been closed and some that have never reopened after the hurricane, where some communities haven't even received any recovery dollars. People who are just tired, and it was that breaking point that they said, I literally have to speak up, and I'm going to show up with my flag. You know, the symbol of the flag is being reborn again as national identity and pride. You know, after not being that for a long time, it is honestly a moment that gives me such hope for not only the future of the island, but for all of our movements to draw from, the same way that every time, you know, we see people find and demand their respect and their dignity, and to know that that is, once you do, you'll never negotiate it again.
What about the forces of repression? I read that late at night around 11 o'clock when people were gathering in front of the governor's mansion, the repressive forces were called out, tear gas was used, rubber bullets were fired at the people. Do you think there'll be a point when the forces of repression in Puerto Rico will lay down and not harm their own people?
I wish I did think that they would eventually step back and realize that they also are, they serve the people. Right. I think that the police force in Puerto Rico thinks that they're an army, thinks that they're a military force, an occupying force, and not a civilian force that actually is there to serve and protect. You know, when I was there last Monday when the police began to start to use tear gas, and I was actually tear gassed in the face, and we were standing there, right? We hadn't invaded the barrier yet. I was probably the oldest amongst all those around me, surrounded by young people who were so clear in their demands when the police began immediately spraying us with tear gas. And of course, you know, that's something that I wouldn't wish on anyone. And that's their historical tactic. The police department in Puerto Rico remains under a consent decree by the U.S. Department of Justice. It's one of the most violent police forces in any U.S. jurisdiction. It also has a long history of being trained by and colluding with the NYPD, for example, which is one of the other most violent and aggressive police forces. It's a police force that sees itself, I believe, as an occupying force. It's the second largest police force in the United States, and has, you know, the 18, 19,000 police members for a population that continues to decrease, you know, 3.2, 3.3 million. That's larger than the LAPD, for example, for a population that's about a third of the size. And the abuse and the tactics that we've seen by the police and the police chief, not only of rubber bullets and of tear gas, but of declaring a suspension of the Constitution, right? And the people of Puerto Rico not only were outraged, but laughed at that. And to the point where last night we saw, you know, an announced protest in front of the governor's mansion of bedtime readings. Let's read the Constitution together before it goes to bed, right? Because, of course, there is no suspension of the Constitution. And yet that also is really reflective of the practical reality that Puerto Rico is a constitution-free zone. There are no real consequences as a result of the economic crisis for violations of constitutional rights. The police act with full impunity every time they assault the rights of a citizen, because you can sue them if you can find a lawyer to take that case and who's willing to wait years and years for attorney's fees. But also, you know, your case will just get suspended. It'll get transferred to debt proceedings. You finally get a judgment, and then the government says, well, we're broke. We can't pay it. So the reality is that it has been a constitution-free zone. Of course, the Constitution, no police chief has the authority to suspend the Constitution. We should never take, advice of our rights from the police. But in practice, there has been tremendous impunity for repeated violations of human rights by the Puerto Rican government and by its law enforcement.
I want to talk some more about what you think the significance of the struggle so far, and then let's talk about what we can do to be informed about it and help support it. But let's talk about the significance of it.
The revolution that is happening in Puerto Rico, because that's what I like to refer to it as, that it's more than just protests and manifestations. It's an uprising. It's a rebellion. It's a revolution. And in the beautiful sense of that word and the long tradition in the Caribbean and Latin America of what that implies. You know, this was front page of every U.S. mainstream newspaper yesterday. The national strike was the front page of the Times, the Washington Post. I mean, even conservative capitalist media has been covering it. But also internationally, the messages of support that have been received and saying, you know, can you share your tear gas mask with us so that we can now challenge our corrupt governments? I mean, that is remarkable. What people are paying attention to and drawing strength from and seeing not only a nation that has been hijacked, but is a colony, and a colony of the most powerful nation on this planet, that is finding their dignity again and rising up, and that their chant is, Somos más y no tenemos miedo. We are more and we are not afraid. They have lost their fear. We have lost our fear. You know, how can you not draw deep inspiration and gratitude from that, from people who are no longer afraid, who are no longer willing to be subjugated to any interest, including their own colonial government's interest? You know, it is such a remarkable moment in history that we should not lose sight of. We should not lose sight of the significance of this, not only for the Puerto Rican nation, which includes the 5 million in the diaspora that have been joining these protests every single day in Washington and New York and Orlando and Milwaukee and LA and in Berlin and Madrid and Colombia, that are demanding and rising up as the Puerto Rican nation, but also what it means for people in struggle all around the world that are pointing to this little rebellious island and saying, if they can do that, so can we. You know, and I think as this moves forward, even should the governor resign or when the governor resigns, recognizing that this struggle, as we say, is for the long run, and that this is much more than about one man, that those, you know, who are listening to this show have hopefully feel compelled to join in supporting the Puerto Rican Revolution, but also, I say, have the obligation and responsibility to do so. Not only in thinking about how to financially support it through organizations like the Maria Fund that are funding movement groups on the island who are going to continue to do this work pre and post Maria, pre and post governor's resignation, that are really about a process of decolonization and centering new model of governance for the island that prioritizes their existence and their lives. But we also have an obligation to denounce colonialism and to call out what our government does in our name. That is the next demand of this nation. Like, let's be very clear that what's next after this resignation is an end to colonialism. is in a thinking of a new form of government. And that, as in every solidarity struggle, cannot be done alone. It is incumbent upon everyone listening to this show and their friends and neighbors and family members to denounce the fact that the United States in 2019 continues to have colonies, despite it being illegal, despite it being immoral, despite every single year the United Nations calling for a process of decolonization. It is our moral duty to stand with the people of Puerto Rico and to denounce what our government has been doing to them and will only intensify as they see a vacuum of leadership and not recognize that it is the people who are going to fill that vacuum, that it is not up to the 60 federal agents they arrived on the island today to do that for them.
Can you tell us and tell our listeners how they can keep informed about what's going on the island and what they can do to lend their support?
There's some great Puerto Rican intellectuals and sites that I'd suggest, you know, definitely on social media, people following, just looking at the hashtag Ricky Renuncia, which is about the resignation, is a great way to kind of keep up with the latest of what's happening. Again, much more than just the resignation, but that really ties in a lot of other activities on the island. But there, you know, there's people like Yarimar Bonilla, a Rutgers professor who frequently publishes, or Rima Brusi, or the Center for Investigative Journalism that also publishes in English as well. Espacios Abiertos which means open spaces, also publishes information in English. There's a number of great resources for folks who want to stay, you know, informed of what's going on. I would suggest not just relying on mainstream media, but really looking at voices from that are being sourced from the island. Mi Gente, which is a U.S.-based organization that works with folks, some of these leaders, actually, young leaders on the island, has been hosting some webinars and sharing information about what's happening. So really just looking to make sure that the information you're hearing, reading, is coming from people on the island and not just being kind of filtered through a mainstream kind of corporate lens.
Well, Natasha Bonin, it's been not just instructive, but inspiring to listen to your report about what's going on the island. For many, many years since I've become a political person, I've been for the independence of Puerto Rico, but I never thought that I would see what's going on now. It's fantastic. We look forward to having you back on Law and Disorder for more reports on the situation, and we thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you so much again, and for always finding space to make sure that, you know, decolonization, colonial struggles, Puerto Rico is always, you know, welcomed in the space and in Law and Disorder and in your programming.
Stay with us. Our next guest is Kevin Zeese from the Embassy Protectors in Washington, D.C. We're going to have him on the phone to talk about the situation there. And could you please stick around for the next few minutes and both of us can interview Kevin?
I'd be happy to, particularly since I had a chance to go visit the protesters and the embassy and get to see what was happening down there. So I look forward to hearing what he has to tell us.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Violation of international law, on May 16, 2019, more than 100 policemen, many with military gear, invaded the embassy of Venezuela in Washington, D.C., and arrested four embassy protectors who were in the embassy with the permission of the Venezuelan government to protect it from a takeover as part of the U.S. coup against the elected Venezuelan government of Nicolas Maduro. The U.S. had attempted to install Juan Guaido as the president of Venezuela, and on May 30th, right-wing coup supporters attempted to take over the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. This coincided with another attempted coup by Juan Guaido in Venezuela. Guaido's failed in his coup attempt. The embassy in Washington, D.C. is the property of Venezuela, and under international law, the United States must protect and is not allowed to enter it. A group of Americans known as the Embassy Protectors Collective moved into the embassy to prevent its hostile takeover. Up to 70 people were sleeping there. The State Department, Secret Service, and the Metropolitan Police Force allowed the pro-coup mob to lay siege to the embassy. People were blocked from entering the embassy. Food was prevented from being brought in. The electricity and water were cut off. Although the coup against the Maduro government failed, the embassy protectors were arrested when the U.S. government raided the embassy. Four embassy protectors, Kevin Zeiss, Margaret Flowers, Adrian Pine, and David Paul, were arrested and faced federal prosecution. If convicted, they could be imprisoned for up to 1 year and face huge fines. We speak today with one of the arrestees, Kevin Zeiss. He is a U.S. lawyer and political activist. He helped organize the 2011 Occupy encampment in Washington, D.C. Kevin Zeiss is currently the co-director of the organization Popular Resistance. Kevin Zeiss, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me on.
Kevin, what was the purpose of the recent United States instigation of a coup against the democratically elected government of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela?
Well, this has really been an ongoing coup almost since the day Chavez was elected in 1998. The most recent coup by Donald Trump was an attempt to substitute an unelected president for an elected president. President Maduro was elected back last May with 67% of the vote, an election where 150 election observers said it met all international standards for democracy, and he was in for 6 years. And that meant 6 years of President Maduro continuing the Bolivarian process, gradually moving towards socialism, and making sure the resources of the country were used to benefit the people. Venezuela has tremendous resources, number one in oil, number one in gold, number one in diamonds, number five in gas, fantastic amounts of minerals that are essential for electronics and for weapons, and a major supply of fresh water. And on top of all that, those resources, which the United States wants to control, especially the minerals, I think that gets underestimated, but the minerals that are essential for electronics and war really are very important to the United States. But beyond that, Venezuela is a symbol of saying no to the United States, a symbol of becoming independent, breaking the Monroe Doctrine, allying with other countries from Europe and around the world, and becoming an independent nation. And that is an example the United States cannot accept.
Kevin, I appreciate you mentioning the elections, and Venezuela obviously has a rich history of great election turnout. I was actually there as an election observer last year for the presidential
election.
We were
both there.
Yeah,
we were both
exactly.
There together, yes.
And yet, despite that, these attempted coups continue to repeat themselves. Why do you think that this last one was not successful?
Well, because the opposition has no popular support of significance beyond the wealthy Venezuelan population. The vast majority of Venezuelans who have benefited greatly under the Bolivarian process, and they know it. And the reality is that the opposition cannot win elections. They were had a fluke victory in the National Assembly election a few years ago, but that was because of the various circumstances we can go into later if you like. But generally, they don't have popular support, and they are unable to win elections of any national scale. They sometimes win gubernatorial or local elections. But because they took a violent approach, the opposition, of putting up violent roadblocks, taking money from people as tolls, committing all sorts of horrendous acts of violence, from lynching to burning people alive, to putting wires up that decapitated motorcycle drivers. I mean, all sorts of horrors. They have lost popular support, and they just can't win it, whether it's an election or a coup. The people are benefiting. The government of Venezuela has built 2.5 million homes for the poorest Venezuelan families. 2.5 million homes means, with four people in a home, that's 10 million people getting free homes. They provide 6 million monthly clap boxes of food and essentials for kitchens at about 15 cents a box. That 6 million, those 6 million boxes again go to four families of four, that's 24 million people out of a 30 million population. So they are doing what they can to benefit their population. That's just two examples: healthcare, education, community centers, urban gardening. There's all sorts of programs going on that benefit the population. And that is why the opposition can't defeat the Bolivarian process from going forward, whether it's Maduro or someone else. That will continue.
So with this last attempted coup, you know, where we saw internationally broadcast videoed message from Guaido announcing this, what was it that the embassy protectors did the day that the coup was announced?
Well, it's interesting. We were already in the embassy beginning on April 10th, because on April 9th, the United States manipulated the Organization of American States rules in order to change it from two-thirds vote required to recognize a new president to a majority vote. And then OAS recognized Guaido. It was barely a majority, and people who voted for it did not feel very good about it, but they did it anyway. And once that happened, the OAS ambassadors from Venezuela were required to leave the country. They gave them the United States gave them 2 weeks, a very short time period. We went into the embassy the next day. Medea Benjamin was the first to go in. We went in the day after, and we were there up through our arrest. And on the day of the coup that you asked about, April 30th, we saw the opposition not only trying to do a coup in Venezuela that failed within a couple hours, but they also came to the embassy. And they worked with the U.S. Secret Service to become a mob that put the embassy under siege. Anyone who left could not get back in. Food was not allowed in. People who were supporting us outside were assaulted by the mob, and the people who were victims of the assault were arrested. They were shouting death threats to us. They were shouting sexual assault threats against women. They were racist, homophobic, anti-female. It was just, you can see why they don't win elections in Venezuela, because they showed the same kind of tendencies with this coup mob siege of the embassy. So we were in the embassy. We were protecting it. We saw ourselves as what we called interim protectors, because under international law, under the Vienna Convention, and really going back to the era of Genghis Khan, when you have diplomatic relations break, countries will use a protecting power agreement to protect the embassy. And that, what that means is a third country becomes the protecting power. In Venezuela, the U.S. Embassy in Caracas was going to be protected by Switzerland, and in the United States, the Venezuelan Embassy in Georgetown, Washington, D.C., was going to be protected by Turkey. And so we wanted a mutual protecting power agreement that would be consistent with international law, so both embassies would be protected. We stayed as interim protectors, hoping that the United States and Venezuela could reach that agreement, and that would be the beginning of positive relations between the U.S. and Venezuela, hopefully as a first step toward negotiating other conflicts the two countries have. So we were there as protectors, and we've stayed until we were forced out.
Given that, what laws do you think that the U.S. government violated by seizing the embassy and not allowing for a third nation to be able to protect it?
Well, the most important law, and the one that we emphasized, is the Vienna Convention. The Vienna Convention requires host countries, in this case the United States, protect embassies of foreign governments in their cities, in their countries. Rather than protecting the embassy, the U.S. government was actually allowing a siege of the embassy. They allowed tents right up to the side of the building, on three sides of the building. The fourth side was a canal, and they allowed people to break into the embassy. Without being arrested, we had multiple people break in, doors broken, windows broken, and we had to have a permission from the Venezuelan government to allow a limited entry into the embassy to take people out who had broken into the embassy. When they were taken out, they got a pat on the back from the Secret Service. They got selfies with their friends. They didn't get arrested at all for breaking and entering, which is amazing. So the thing that they broke on the day we were arrested, on May 16th, was they came in with force. They had more than 100 police, five different police forces. They had many police in military gear using a battering ram to break into the embassy. This violated the Vienna Convention, and when they broke into the embassy, they came in to find us, we immediately we told them where we were. We're on the second floor. We're in the conference room. We weren't like resisting their arrest. We just not we're not voluntarily leaving. And so we were there with the permission of the Venezuelan government. We were legally there. We were given the keys. We were not unlawfully enter. And so we, throughout this process, we told the government that we were lawful, and that if they came in, they would be the ones breaking the law. And they did it anyway. And I think that puts U.S. embassies around the world at risk. It puts embassies all across the nation, world at risk, not just U.S. embassies, because the Vienna Convention, if it's not there to protect embassies, then embassy personnel at risk. And so we told the police, actually, 2 days before the arrest, they came and broke down the front door, unlocked, took the locks off the front door, came into the into the entranceway. We were inside waiting for them, and we had about a 45-minute conversation with them where we explained that we were here lawfully, they were violating the law, and as they came in, they were risking U.S. embassies around the world. If they heard personnel from U.S. embassies killed in future years, they should think back to this moment, because this moment, when you broke across that threshold and violated the Vienna Convention, you created a law of a jungle where embassies were not protected. We also explained how entering the embassy in violation of the Vienna Convention could escalate tensions between U.S. and Venezuela. And there's already military threats. You have Colombia and Brazil allied with the United States. You have China and Russia allied with Venezuela. And so a military conflict could be escalated into a global conflict. And we said, if you cross the threshold, you can tell your grandchildren you broke the law and started World War III. we urged them to turn around and go back and talk to their superiors because it was a very serious error under the law and under the tradition of how embassies are treated by host governments. They did turn around and talk to their personnel, but they came back a few days later and arrested us. And I think a key turning point in that decision was when Jesse Jackson came to the embassy, and we were able to get 3 bags of food up through a window by rope, pulling bags up a major battle conflict with the coup mob to do that. And when they knew we had more food and they knew we were planning on staying, they had to make a choice. Are we going to let this go on for another month or 2 months, or are we going to risk breaking the law and coming in and unlawfully arresting us? They chose the latter, and now we're facing federal charges for interfering with protective functions, a charge I've never heard of before. I'm not sure there's any case law on it, but it does exist in the statute. And we're facing federal charges where we could face 1 year in jail each and up to a $100,000 fine. And they're threatening to charge us with the cost of the police and any damage to the embassy. We didn't do any damage to the embassy, but they're threatening that as well. That their plea bargain so far has been plead guilty and face the consequences. That's been their plea offer. So they are looking to put us in jail for protecting the embassy.
What can our listeners do to remain informed about the situation and support you?
Well, there's popularresistance.org is our main website, and we have in the slider at the top of the page information about the Embassy Protection Collective and the group that's come together to defend us, to defend embassy protectors, and people can participate by working with that group. Because we're kind of feeling a little bit silenced as a result of facing charges. So we are really counting on the movement to use this case to continue the effort to protect the embassy and to move toward peace between U.S. and Venezuela, respect of sovereignty for both countries. So defendembassyprotectors.org. DefendEmbassyProtectors.org is the site for the group that's come together to support us. In addition to doing the work of organizing and mobilizing people, they're also raising money for our defense. We want to raise about $50,000. We've raised about 10 so far, and so we're working to raise funds for our defense. We feel very confident that if we put forward our defense, a jury will recognize that we were acting lawfully. And as we said throughout the whole process, we were lawful, not breaking any laws. It's interesting they didn't charge us with some other obvious, like trespass or something, but we weren't trespassing. We were there with the legitimacy of the Venezuelan government. And so it's a very strange case, but John Bolton and Elliot Abrams and Michael Pence and Pompeo and Trump are not very happy that we delayed this coup attempt. They wanted to take this embassy over right from the beginning, and we stopped that for 37 days.
Kevin Zeis, one of the embassy protectors, is our guest this morning. I wanted to ask you about the sanctions that the United States has placed against Venezuela. What has been their effect? What does the United States hope to accomplish?
The sanctions are very important. This is something that the U.S. is abusing in Venezuela and other parts of the world. What they really are is unilateral coercive measures which are illegal under international law and violate the U.N. Charter. We are very pleased to see the non-aligned movement just had a meeting this last week where they came out against the unilateral coercive measures as well as the threats against Venezuela. The impact in Venezuela is devastating. Venezuela is working to combat them, developing a resistance economy, but that takes time. As we stand right now, there's just a report that came out that said that in the last 2 years there have been 40,000 deaths as a result of the U.S.'s sanctions, their unilateral coercive measures, 40,000 deaths, because Venezuela used to be one of the excellent countries as far as pharmaceuticals go. They had a very strong pharmaceutical industry producing their own pharmaceuticals. With the sanctions, they can't get the ingredients to produce pharmaceuticals. So half of those pharmaceutical companies have closed down, and people really can't get the medicine they need, and that's one of the major causes of the tens of thousands of deaths. We saw the same kind of thing with sanctions when they were used in Iraq, hundreds of thousands of deaths as a result of U.S. sanctions before the invasion. And this is the U.S. way of war. They weaken a country and then they attack. This is what the U.S. has done really since the indigenous era when the Indian Wars were going on. They weakened the indigenous tribes by killing their buffalo. They'd be destroying their crops. Those are the brute force sanctions of that era. These are sanctions as well, and they are having a big impact, but they are uniting the country around Maduro. Maduro is not a perfect president, but he's doing an incredible job under attack by the United States. But rather than focusing on his weaknesses, people are uniting around him, and because there's a very strong understanding of U.S. imperialism in Venezuela. We had amazing experiences in Venezuela with people from the street to barrios to in the government, popular movements. There's a strong, strong understanding of U.S. imperialism and the need for unity to protect their sovereignty. So they're having the effect of devastating the economy, killing people, but uniting the country against U.S. invasion.
We've been speaking with attorney Kevin Zeis in Washington, D.C. He's one of the four people that were arrested for protecting the Venezuelan embassy. You can reach out to them at embassyprotectors.org. Kevin, we're at the end of our allotted time here, so I'm regretting to have to say goodbye to you, but we thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. We look forward to having you back for updates on this, and we wish you every success.
Thank you so much. There's a lot more to say about Venezuela. I just want people to understand one thing, and I'm sure your co-host will agree with me on this. When you go to Venezuela, you realize that we're not only being told lies about Venezuela, not gray lies, a slight change, but opposite of reality. Venezuela is a deep democracy, not a dictatorship. People are not starving. There's no homeless. The economy is in trouble because of the U.S. sanctions, but the government is responding. We are being told lie after lie in order to create the situation that will allow a military attack in the future. So doubt what you're told. Popular Resistance covers Venezuela on a regular basis, as do other sites. Try to reach out and find information so you can help others. Our job as activists, the first job, is to correct the record. So I really appreciate being on the show and you taking the time to interview me.
You take it easy, Kevin Zeis.
All right, thank you.
So long.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.